seated. Okay. First matter we have this morning is docket number 69381, Birch versus District Court. And are we ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, why don't you come up? And would you like to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 2 minutes.
2 minutes, got it.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Rick Perdomo. I'm with the Office of the Attorney General. I'm here with Jim Rosenberger, who is co-counsel in this case, and we have the pleasure of representing the petitioner, Larry L. Birch. The question before this Court is whether a special master is entitled to absolute quasi-judicial immunity from suit. And the short answer is yes. The record from the Bion litigation, which is the district court case which this action arises from, establishes that Special Master Birch was acting in a quasi-judicial capacity and is entitled to absolute quasi-judicial immunity to the same extent as a receiver or some other court-appointed professional. Absolute immunity bars Bloom's claims, the real party in interest, for relief, which challenged determinative acts, quasi-judicial acts, taken within the course and scope of Special Master Birch's immunity, and also challenges underlying acts which resulted in those determinative quasi-judicial acts, which are also immune from suit. Finally, there is no legal authority that Special Master Birch is aware of that supports Mr. Bloom's arguments that this immunity may be waived. And if the court is even considering adopting such an exception to this immunity, the alleged waiver in the order of appointment in this case is too ambiguous to be enforceable. So the first question that we must ask in determining whether absolute quasi-judicial immunity applies in this case is whether the functional approach, as applied to his acts, establishes that he was acting similar to a judge. In addition, the second prong of that analysis is whether these acts took place in a setting that is similar to a court setting, such that it is protected by constitutionally protected procedures and also from political influences. The first prong of that analysis is satisfied. As the order,
is there a third question, counsel? Did the special master exceed the limits of the authority granted by the court, notwithstanding the quasi-judicial immunity? We do have some cases, even our own case, Anna, seems to suggest that where the court's order places some constraints or some exceptions around immunity, that we should pay attention to that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Ames does indicate that where a receiver faithfully carries out the orders of the appointing court, then he shares in the judge's immunity. Now, in this case, if
you look... It's kind of an odd decision, though, don't you think, when you look at the comments made in some other federal cases, like Nystead and Ashelman and others, where they say that the quasi-judicial immunity is extended to a special master in the same way that the judge would have quasi-judicial immunity, and even makes this statement that the fact that a court-appointed officer performs a judicial function in an imperfect or even unethical way does not by itself dissolve the quasi-judicial immunity. Do we have a conflict in our own case law between the holding in Annis, which seems to require a good faith performance, and the other cases that extend quasi-judicial immunity and the functional equivalent test? And if so, should we revisit those cases?
I think Annis is somewhat distinguishable from those cases, in that the court in Ashelman v. Pope and in Nystead, they were looking at the determinative act to determine whether the acts were within the scope of immunity. And if they were, then the underlying acts which were alleged to be unethical or improper, were also immune from suit as well because they focused on completing that ultimate task. And the court in those cases, in my interpretation, did not want to open up a quasi-judicial officer from to liability related to allegations, which may or may not be true, related to functions that were within his scope of power. So in Ennis, what we're looking at is an actual determinative act. The order in that case indicated that the receiver was to modify or cancel leases. And the question there was whether that receiver actually acted within the scope of that power. And the court determined that the alleged harassing conduct, was not within the scope of that power. We don't have that issue here.
Really? How is that any different from the allegations in the complaint that Bursch acted in gross negligence, which was one of the exceptions contained expressly set out in the order?
Because based on the record from the court, Special Master Bursch acted within the scope of his immunity. He was granted broad powers of discovery. He was granted fairly broad powers to make findings related to the legitimacy and veracity of Murder, Inc. or Plume's business. And I think the record supports that he did that. He conducted discovery, he analyzed it, and he made those findings.
This was a motion to dismiss, or was it converted to a summary judgment because matters outside the complaint were considered?
It was a motion to dismiss, Your Honor. And
okay, so everything, and knowing the standard for evaluating a motion to dismiss, how do we get to this point other than what's alleged in the complaint?
Sure. As the court is aware, on a motion to dismiss, there are very limited things that the court can consider in deciding that type of motion. One thing that the court can consider is facts that the court can take judicial notice of. And with respect to the exhibits that were offered in support of Mr. Bursch's motion to dismiss, they were all court records. And court records are subject to or things that the court can take judicial notice of as far as what they say. So consideration of those court records, I believe, is well.
So you're saying the report itself is part of the court records?
That was part of the exhibit submitted in the underlying action as part of the motion to dismiss.
Okay, so how do we get from there other than what's alleged in the complaint, that there was no gross negligence, no willful misconduct, et cetera?
I think the court and I think the record supports that the court did consider those documents. In the brief below in the district court, I did cite to the standard for taking judicial notice of those records. And I can tell you that in the record from that hearing, the court did consider those documents.
I'm confused, counsel. I thought your argument in this case is that regardless of what the records might show, the quasi-judicial immunity applies to accountants, period. And the fact that there might have been some conflict with Lionel Sawyer and Collins, or the fact that there might have been ex-party communications between the special master and that firm, and the fact that there may have been some awkward or defamatory statements made in the special report doesn't matter, because if it's quasi-judicial immunity, the case should be dismissed as a matter of law.
That's correct.
What you're talking about now in terms of referring to the record under a standard on a motion to dismiss would seem that we shouldn't even entertain this writ. Now, which is your position here?
Our position,
and if it's to be decided as a matter of law, how do you address the limitations in the court's order as to the scope of the immunity?
Our position is that this can be decided as a matter of law and should be decided as a matter of law. because that is what absolute immunity is. So if the court wants to just look at the complaint and what is in the complaint, those actions under a quasi-judicial immunity analysis are barred from suit.
But do they, does that analysis apply as to the undisclosed conflict that arguably disabled Mr. Birch from serving, but it wasn't disclosed, the other side didn't know it? That to me seems a little different than once you're appointed and you have an allegation of ex parte conflicts thereafter.
I think it does apply across the board because there are procedural processes in place to bring that to the court. If there is an issue with that, with Special Master Birch's alleged conflict of interest, then what's appropriate is a motion to disqualify.
But if it's not disclosed at the moment of his retention and unknown to the other side, should judicial immunity attach, absolute judicial immunity or quasi-judicial immunity to that?
I think so, because what we have is a situation where the conflict of interest is not known until it's known by the person. And I think that what the record supports or what the complaint supports is that it was disclosed. So at that point...
But not the process, at the inception.
My understanding is it wasn't. But I'll tell you that based on the authorities that we have before us, that absolute is absolute. And there are procedures in place to challenge these very acts and any questionable nature of the decision-making process or the acts taken by the quasi-judicial officer or a judicial officer with respect to immunity.
So let me restate the question this way. I've asked it a couple of different ways. Is this court's holding in Ennis at odds with the functional immunity test that was embodied in Ducharme and Duff and Marvin?
I think it is, Your Honor. quite frank, absolute is absolute, and what the court should be concerned with is whether the acts taken by the officer are within the subject matter jurisdiction, their subject matter jurisdiction. That is what the law says with respect to judicial officers. If we are going to extend that immunity to quasi-judicial officers and allow these officers to stand in the place of a judicial officer with respect to this immunity, yes, I do believe that holding would be at odds with other case law.
Are you familiar with a case out of the First Circuit, Kermit Construction versus Banco Crediti?
I read it, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What's your view of how that case may limit the scope of the quasi-judicial immunity to a requirement that the special master must still demonstrate a faithful, carefully completion of the order of the appointing judge?
Sure, Your Honor. Well, as you are aware, the Nystead case was also decided out of the First Circuit as well.
Yeah.
So I think what they are looking at is two different people. I think they're looking at two different functions. A receiver and a special master are two different types of they serve two different types of functions. One, a receiver potentially stands in place of a business entity and conducts different services for that business entity when they take over during litigation. A special master, as in this case, would take over and essentially conduct some discovery and assist the judge in making judicial findings or the trier of fact. So I think they're two different people.
Good. That's helpful.
If there's no more questions.
Any other questions? You know what? We tune into your time pretty well. We peppered you with a lot of questions. I'm going to give you an additional 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
You chewed it up. So I'll offer that to opposing counsel as well. I'll give you an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Let me ask you this, first of all. Is a motion to dismiss the proper vehicle to challenge this? Is there a different way to do that? I mean, if you're going to allege that he wandered outside the scope of what the judge commissioned him for, essentially, and that he's committed willful misconduct, gross negligence, or something, a conflict of interest that would cause him to lose any absolute quasi-judicial immunity he may have, how do you test that on a motion to dismiss unless it's converted to a motion for summary judgment?
You're exactly right, Your Honor, and that's exactly what happened here. It was converted to a motion for summary judgment. And 56F
opposing counsel just said it wasn't.
It was because 56F relief was granted so that we can conduct discovery. The minute we started conducting discovery is when the writ was filed that brought this up here. And I believe Judge Corey, what he found was, just like in Annis, we have to allow discovery to see if these claims are legitimate. We need a full record to go up on these claims because these are claims of fraud, willful misconduct, gross negligence. These aren't negligence-based claims. These are claims that have substance and an intent element to it. And he gave us 56F relief so that we could go forward on discovery. No discovery was conducted because the script was then taken. So I believe, to answer your question, Your Honor, there has to be discovery before we can come to a conclusion on this issue.
Well, not if the quasi-judicial immunity doctrine applies absolutely, which is the legal question that we're all discussing here today. So why doesn't that doctrine bar your complaint outright?
And it goes back to Your Honor's question on Annis, because there has to be some discovery as to that issue. If there's a fraud-based allegation, when we look at the history of case law in Nevada on this issue, they're negligence-based claims. And the functional approach test is determinative whether quasi-judicial immunity even applies. We have some other issues in this case, which is, did the order appointing Special Master Birch have a carve-out that was effectively a stipulation to qualified immunity? Everybody operated under that order. And paragraph 12 of that order is abundantly clear in that the special master will not be held liable for any acts.
I didn't see a case cited in your brief, or I haven't seen any in our own research, which says that a special master appointed under Rule 53 with these qualifications, these exceptions, overcomes absolute quasi-judicial immunity. Have you?
No, I have not, Your Honor. I have not, and we looked extensively. I was counsel in the underlying case, and we looked extensively in these pleadings for it.
So when one gets into this issue, how would this court, if it were going to create what appears to potentially be one of the first in the country's exception, how would we frame that opinion? What would be the explanation that one would offer? What would be the analytics and the opinion to do that?
I think the opinion would be consistent with what this court has done in the last year with the Harrison versus Reutemann case and the Slezak versus Corey case. There are two opinions that I think are consistent with what we're asking for today. In the Harrison case or Reutemann, this court has a footnote that specifically addresses that acts of that our adoption of this doctrine, the quasi-judicial immunity, does not protect an expert's fraudulent acts. And I think this case would then give that clarification as to what happens in a situation when
But this individual wasn't serving in the capacity of an expert. I know that you argued that in the first case, that he should have been treated as an expert, but clearly he was acting pursuant to a court order under Rule 53. The judge in the first case rejected your argument that he was an expert, so does the footnote in Reutemann provide guidance in the context of a special master? I don't think so, does it?
I think it does because in the underlying case, the judge never adopted the special master's report under Rule 53. And under Rule 53, there has to be a finding that it was clearly erroneous if they did not adopt it. Judge Thurman did not adopt his report. And what she said was, because so much time and effort have been put into that report, I'm going to allow you guys to utilize it with cross-examination as if it were an expert report. So it was never adopted under Rule 53.
Does Rule 53 require the judge to enter some order that sanctifies the report? Doesn't Rule 53 just have you file the report and the point of the report is the parties can argue the report and its veracity and its conclusions anyway?
Well, 53A says with a non-jury trial, which we had in the underlying Bayon case, that the court shall adopt that report unless it's clearly erroneous.
Mm-hmm.
The court did not adopt that report.
Well, you never got to the question, though, because the bankruptcy interceded the issue. So
correct.
You never really got to the determination about whether it was clearly erroneous.
That's correct. That is correct. And, Your Honor, it goes back to our first point on this is, given where this court has been going with the functional approach test, extending immunity to experts in Whiteman or a receiver in the Corey case, what we have here is a unique situation because we have the order appointing a special master that clearly lays out the scope of his duties and a carve-out as to what his immunity is. So we have the issue of whether he stipulated to qualified immunity. Can he stipulate to qualified immunity? And it's important to note that Mr. Birch was represented by counsel at the time that order was made. It's actually in paragraph 7 of that order. It states that pursuant to the special master's request, counsel will be appointed. And there was never an objection to that order. Everybody followed that order. And that was the order in place as to what he was paid, the amount of his retainer, and the scope of his duties. And there was also the carve-out. He could not be sued for negligence. That's consistent with this court's law. However, he could be sued for fraud, willful misconduct, gross negligence. And as Your Honor pointed out...
Well, aren't those all aspects of conduct outside the scope of the order?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's our position, that they were completely outside the scope of the order. Because one, the non-disclosure of an active attorney-client relationship with the opposing counsel puts into question his ability to be appointed. And now we have a failure to disclose for over a year until Lionel Sawyer finally disclosed it. And Mr. Birch was at every hearing. He sat in every hearing, had every opportunity to make that disclosure. And in fact, he argued during the sanction hearing, I'm not subject to disclosure because I'm not subject to the Nevada rules of professional conduct because I'm not an attorney, or the Nevada judicial canons because I'm not a judge. Now he wants to use that same framework as a shield now when he's going to be sued for fraudulent and collusive actions. And they're very serious allegations. He never wrote that final report. It was sent to Lionel Sawyer Collins without my knowledge because I should have included that as counsel for Mr. Bloom. The report comes back with language of Ponzi scheme. He engaged in Ponzi scheme that gets published. And that's not his finding. So when he signs off on that, he's committing fraud.
Okay, so now that's easy to allege, and I'm sure in many instances it could be alleged. And the conflict you're specifically referring to, outside the fact that perhaps this was sent to Lionel Sawyer and Collins at some point, the conflict that you're referring to regarded his representation his representation by Lionel Sawyer and Collins how many years prior to this?
It was active at the time of his appointment.
As far as his tax issue was concerned, that and they were representing him at the time he had taken this appointment, and it was unrelated to this particular litigation.
That's correct, but it was an active representation that extended at least 3 or 4 months past his appointment. That was never disclosed. And it was the fact that Judge Sturman said it was troubling to her. Had he disclosed it, we would have never agreed to him as a special master. And what we have then is a pattern of collusive conduct with Lionel Sawyer, where he's working with them to effectively build a case against Mr. Bloom. And that's not the role of the special master. The role of the special master is to be an independent arm of the court.
Well, that's your argument, that he was building a case. And specifically, what are the confines as to special master's duties and obligations? Is a special master by rule or by... is a special master required to have input from you before he does... any compilation of his report?
Yes.
And what rule is that?
It's Rule 53, Subsection 5, that says...
Saying what?
A draft report must be sent to both counsel.
Okay, and this is, we're not talking about a draft report. We're talking about the compilation of the report and the investigation going into the compilation of the report. So that doesn't necessarily mean that a draft report hasn't been circulated. You're talking about actions leading up to a draft report.
No, I'm saying that the draft report that was circulated to Lionel Sawyer that was not sent to me as counsel for...
I thought you said Lionel Sawyer created the report.
There was a draft report sent to Lionel Sawyer in October of 2012. That report was then changed and sent back to the special
master. Okay, so why wouldn't that be a draft report rather than a preliminary mishmash of findings? And how can you consider that? And this is getting off subject. This is, you know, this we're making this much broader than it needs to be.
I think I can answer that pretty quickly. He had done a preliminary report in November of 2011. He was supposed to do a final report that was in October of 2012. The draft of the final report is what we are taking issue with, because that initial draft that was drafted by the special master had no mention of the word Ponzi scheme in there. When Lionel Sawyer gets it and it gets back to them, there's language of Ponzi scheme that Mr. Bloom engaged in acts of Ponzi scheme, and that's not the finding of the special
master. Is there any rule that requires that he not have input from any other source? That everything that he does is of his own investigation and doing, or can he utilize resources beyond his own to create a report or a draft report or input that doesn't go into a report?
No, he absolutely can. It's his job. He absolutely can. You know, our issue is not with that. Our issue is with working with his counsel that was never disclosed to build a case and then let them draft the final report. And then sign off as if it's independent. That's our case. And we were allowed to get some emails in that underlying case that did support these allegations. So the basis of our claim has some evidentiary background to it. Mm-hmm. And that's why we were able to, and we brought that in front of Judge Corey, which is why it was converted to a motion to.
Isn't the whole concept between absolute quasi-judicial immunity one of the... one of the aspects is that those that are helping the court and the court requests help in this regard be shielded from litigation.
Absolutely.
And wouldn't why wouldn't in every case you you have allegations? You could have allegations of fraud. You could have allegations of this nature and basically do away with that important aspect of absolute quasi-judicial immunity.
It is an important factor that should shield against negligence lawsuits or a failure or a omission on an accident that leads to a negligent claim. But when you have allegations of fraud, which requires a heightened pleading, these are serious allegations that we shouldn't, that we need to protect against. You have the chilling effect or the lightning rod for litigation that this court has previously spoken about. That needs to be balanced with protecting the public from fraud. We're not condoning fraud. We're not allowing our citizens to be subject to an independent arm of the court committing fraud. And
so,
it's a serious
so would
allegation.
You agree that the defamation claim should have been dismissed?
It's
not fraud-based.
Correct. Yeah, and I said that in front of Judge Corey that if that's the case, the defamation claim would be dismissed if you're not defined qualified, or if you're going to go based on the language of Judge Sturman's order. The three claims that would survive are the willful misconduct, the gross negligence, and the fraud claim, and that's what we started discovery on before we got to the writ.
But he denied the motion to dismiss as to all the claims, didn't he?
He did, because he wanted a full record. And so that was his exact answer. Let's come back on a full record. He had an expedited discovery schedule. And we were going to come back after, I believe, a 90-day period to...
But that didn't happen, right?
No, it did not. The minute the order was entered, we sent out subpoenas and began the process of doing discovery. The writ was filed, and the case was stayed so that we can have this issue decided.
What do you hope to unearth by your discovery that would alter the legal question presented?
To confirm what the initial discovery we have already shows, which is that Lionel Sawyer Collins, as Mr. Birch's active counsel, drafted a report that was, when Mr. Birch signed off on it, was effectively fraud. When he signed, it said it was independent finding. This was actually the finding of Lionel Sawyer Collins and their client. Because tellingly, 2 weeks before this report is entered, I'm deposing the CEO of the company who's making allegations of Ponzi scheme. First time we ever heard these words in the case.
Was there any interaction between your client and Lionel Sawyer Collins? Is there any reason that would prompt them to do that? What motive would they have to do something like that?
It's a great question. I don't know what their motive was, but
and so which begs the question again. Going back to a special master using other resources and incorporating that into a report, how does that constitute fraud?
If he's utilizing other resources, it obviously doesn't. He's allowed to do that. That's the scope of his powers. If he's allowing someone else, who's the opposing adversary in the case, to draft the report, and then he says this is an independent finding.
Wait, the opposing adversary was Lionel Sawyer Collins?
Lionel Sawyer Collins represented Vion Operations, who was the adversary to Mr. Bloom in that case.
Okay, now
so your point is that he was a cat's paw for Lionel Sawyer, his clients, or his lawyers, who also represented your opponent.
Absolutely.
And that's why you're saying the disclosure at the outset was important.
Absolutely. And the federal rules of civil procedure, Rule 53, require that disclosure. The matter doesn't have that, and that's one of the things that we discussed at the underlying case. But yeah, that is something that would have definitely altered the course of these proceedings.
Assuming for the moment that Lionel Sawyer participated in or drafted the report, other than the statement in the report that this was a Ponzi scheme, to Justice Pickering's earlier question, what do you intend to identify in discovery that shows other errors in the report that are occasioned by virtue of gross negligence and fraud?
That's the biggest one. That's the one that's had the most harm on Mr. Bloom. He lost a significant investor because when you Google his name, and in the Las Vegas Sun reported that an independent special master found that there was earmarks of a Ponzi scheme, and that is a death knell to someone who's involved in real estate investing. The other issue is
you if you concede that the defamation claim should be appropriately dismissed, then what's the basis for the claim of fraud? Just the assertion that what the master found in this report amounts to a Ponzi scheme?
No, my assertion is he never made that finding. It was the adversary who made that finding, and he signed it as if it was independent.
Okay, so that's the extent of the error in the report or the basis for gross negligence or fraud?
Correct.
Okay. Don't know that a lot of discovery would be required for that issue.
Well, that's why there was only 90 days that was given to us, I outlined directly what I wanted to do in my 56-hour relief, and we could have gotten right to that.
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
No, he asked my follow-up, so okay. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Counsel, you've got two additional minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. With respect to the case that was cited in Harrison v. Reutemann, the footnote relates to a Sixth Circuit case which indicates that the doctrine does not shield from liability alleged in conspiracies to falsify non-testimonial evidence. So I think that last part is pertinent because we're not dealing with an expert's testimonial evidence, which is in court, but it seems like it's non-testimonial evidence falsifying that. So that's where the...
Wait, you got to say that again. I'm not sure...
Sure.
If you've got a statement in a report that indicates that there's a Ponzi scheme, tell me again why that's not...
Generally, those statements in any order for the court are protected. They're generally protected under judicial immunity. If a court If a judge puts in a finding related to a legal finding related to a Ponzi scheme in an order, those are protected. This is no different. This is a document filed by the court.
The difference here is that they're alleging that there was fraud in the sense that Lionel Sawyer and Collins created this report essentially and added the language regarding the Ponzi scheme at the same time Lionel Sawyer and Collins was representing him as a client.
My question is, why is it coming up now? Why wasn't this addressed in the other action? What discovery was completed in that action? It seems more appropriate to unearth this as part of the judicial process, which is what absolute quasi-judicial immunity is meant to enforce, is to enforce that judicial process. Take care of this in that action. Don't file a collateral civil action against a special master after the fact. Use the procedures that are available to you to resolve this issue.
Well, but those procedural safeguards discussed in Marvin and Duff are cut off when there was an intervening bankruptcy proceeding. So why wouldn't we permit discovery, at least in this case, where that opportunity had been lost through apparently no fault of Mr. Bloom?
I think a look at the record would suggest that there was an opportunity for this, several months of opportunity to conduct this discovery prior to this removal to bankruptcy court.
How do we know that? How do we know what was available in the Vion case after the bankruptcy, given that this case was resolved on a motion to dismiss? I'm a little concerned about the propriety of writ relief.
Yeah.
I understand your absolute immunity argument.
And I agree. On a motion to dismiss, if we're looking straight at the complaint, then we need to just focus on that, and we're not looking at discovery, and we're looking at the actions that are alleged, which are judicial, quasi-judicial in nature, and therefore would be protected.
Right, but the allegation is that the appointment was tainted by the undisclosed conflict, and then the other case died, so they weren't able to avail themselves of the ordinary corrective measures in that litigation. And we don't really know precisely because it was decided on a motion to dismiss. I'm a little concerned about whether this would have been appropriate to let it go forward on discovery. And if you lose on summary judgment, have another writ that would have a fully developed record that would allow us to refine the conflict in our case law. Could he answer that question?
Oh, certainly. Please do.
Absolutely. And I think it's very short that quasi-judicial immunity is by its very purpose, meant to protect these individuals and judges from the exact thing that you are suggesting should happen in this case. It's protecting them from litigation related to these types of allegations. And we don't know whether they're true or not. And that's something that we have to live with. But ultimately, it's absolute. And anybody could come forward and make those allegations.
Well, not the
case.
Undisclosed conflict that may have tainted the initial appointment. That's the piece of this that kind of troubles me.
Well, and the part that troubles me as well is if we take your position, how do you ever get to the point where you make a determination as to whether or not absolute immunity is going to apply in this particular instance, because you can't test whether or not the actions fell out of the scope of the actions that would have been protected by absolute immunity.
You have to look at what's alleged in the complaint, and what's alleged in the complaint relates directly to his functions as special master and creating a final report and conducting discovery. And that's, you know, unfortunately, that's what we have to live with, is what's pled in the complaint, and what's pled in the complaint falls directly under the scope of quasi-judicial immunity here.
Anything further. Thank you.
Just as hard as Steve.
No, thank you, counsel.
All right. Thank you both. This is